The title of tonight's discussion is Gut Bodhicitta, and that came from walking at Spirit Rock one day, looking at someone's bumper sticker and seeing Gut Bodhicitta, and I love it. Much like Gut Milk, Gut Bodhicitta. This talk is really based on the last few weeks of my life, looking at bodhicitta, looking at compassion, starting with a talk with a Year to Live group I was with, and Chris was there, and one person talked about life, finding your life's purpose. Mm-hmm. And I remember, and I said, I don't think that resonates with me. Finding your life's purpose, it feels too purposeful. And as if there's been something kind of predetermined or predestined and you're supposed to find it. But listening to this person's understanding of purpose, it was pretty eye-opening. And then I, like maybe some of you, found out about what Oprah is doing in this in the world right now. How many people know what Oprah is doing with Eckhart Tolle? Yes.
We talked about it here last week.
Did you?
Yeah.
All right.
That's why we're so well informed.
So what?
That's why we're so well informed.
Oh, great. So has anyone turned on to Oprah and Eckhart?
Well, I listened to it.
Oh, that's right. You didn't turn on to it.
Okay. No, no. I mean, I enjoyed it. But,
yes.
I didn't.
So you turn on the computer and you check out Oprah and you can find out more. Some of you already know that. The title of the book, Eckhart Tolle's second book, is Awakening to Your...
A New Earth.
And it's called A New Earth, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose. So it was kind of a resonance with this discussion I'd had and these thoughts already. And I kept thinking, what's he going to talk about your, how is he going to talk about your purpose and what is that purpose? So I've been turning on the computer and listening and finding out that what he means by that is very, very much what the Dalai Lama meant when he wrote his book on happiness and said that the purpose of life is to be happy. That's a huge statement. The purpose of life is to be happy. And it can sound overwhelming and not something that I, whoever I am, can accomplish in this lifetime. Just to survive sometimes in the midst of a difficult time seems like an ideal in some ways. So what he means, the Dalai Lama, in the purpose of life is to be happy, I think is very much about what Eckhart Tolle is talking about as far as finding your life's purpose, which is freedom in awakening to the truth of what is in this moment and no other. It's only in this moment. I used to be really inspired. I still am, but I used to be really inspired in the beginning of practice by Christopher Titmus, going to sit with Christopher Titmus, who is kind of a wild fellow, was an experience in many ways. Part of it was that he would say, you know, awakening is just right now. It's not in the future. It's all about right now. That's inspiring to me. It's not about some other time, because there is no other time. Eckhart Tolle's first book is The Power of Now. It is right now. That's all we have. It sure doesn't seem that way, though, sometimes, does it? Sure doesn't seem that way when we're run in those moments by the past, when our present is so conditioned by what's already happened in the past, that we're locked into a storyline of the way things are, that locks us in and doesn't open us to the possibility of right now. What's going on now? Right now. The future? Who knows? I mean, we hear that. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? The future's only now, too. It's all right now. All right now. I've been thinking about this now-ness quite a bit lately. Some of you know that I was diagnosed with breast cancer in December and have had surgery. And I've been pretty present in the process of being here right now with what's going on. That gets a little dicey in the times, because we do live in the relative world, and there is daylight savings time, and there are times when I'm waiting for news about diagnoses. Those times are more challenging. Those times of waiting for something else to happen can be challenging. We can forget that it's all about right now. I realized last week, though I thought in much of this time that I was very present with emotions that come, thoughts that come, not all the time because, you know, I don't want you to get the wrong idea. But I realized that I'd been waiting for something, this news, when I got when I decided to call about a test on this tumor that will tell me whether I'm at low, intermediate, or high risk of recurrence and ultimate death from this breast cancer. Not to make it too dramatic, but that's what the test is for. And I called a day before I thought it was going to be ready, just to see, because sometimes things are ready early. And my experience with waiting for the pathology report in January was that it was late. So I thought if they heard my voice a day early, maybe they'd remember the next day and it would be ready. And I got the news that not only was it not ready, but it had never been ordered. And it was supposed to have been ordered 13 days before, 12 days before, and due and ready to be, and ready for me to know if I need to add chemo and whether I can start radiation or wait a bit for chemotherapy. And I called the doctor's office, talked to the nurse who'd already heard from the place that was doing the testing, and said, you know, I'm sorry, I filled in the wrong paperwork. And no, it hasn't been ordered. It was around that time, after I said goodbye, that I realized that I'd been waiting, because I was very agitated. It was very frustrating, very agitating, because I knew that it meant, oh, now they have to get this and start all over, which is at least another 2 weeks, which is another delay in treatment. And quite honestly, it wasn't so much the delay in treatment so much as the delay in the other things in my life that I was wanting to do. I was wanting to teach mindfulness-based stress reduction. Now I'm not sure I'm going to, because it's going to push me right up to the edge. And quite frankly, I really want to take care of this body and these emotions that come and go. And I want to take care right now. So if you're in the middle of, put yourself in your own life, the middle of bad news for you. You've labeled it bad news. See what happens inside. Just remember that in your own body, mind. What happened in this body, mind, was the desire to do something. I want to do something. What can I do? Kind of like a... In other words, looking for a distraction to get to squirm away from this now that wasn't feeling very pleasant. This now didn't feel good. So instead of grabbing food or anything else, I decided to go in the hot tub. because I love the hot tub. I'm very grateful I have a hot tub and I get to go in it. I have a hot tub. In the morning, it somewhat identifies me, I must admit. It is Bonnie in the hot tub. And I went in the hot tub, even though it wasn't the morning, it was later, and sat there and looked up at the sky and intended to be present by opening up to a bigger picture, opening up to the world in a bigger way than me and my story. And I opened up, and there's the sky, and there's the clouds, and things coming and going, and there's the birds chirping. And then it was clutch down in the heart, and feeling tightness in my body, and just feeling frustration and sadness, and I cried. And I just sat there in my hot tub and cried. And I'll tell you, it was the wisest thing I could have done. Opening up is one perspective to the bigger picture, and it's helpful. Yet I was, in a way, squirming away from the truth of that moment, which was, this sucks. This is really hard. And crying was just a big release. It was a big release. It was the truth of how I felt. And at that point, after crying, my heart just opened up to how hard it was. Not only that moment in the hot tub, but I can't, you know, now I can't do this, and now I can't do that. You know, this whole practice is a microcosm. This cancer practice is a microcosm of life. It's what is inevitable. Okay, this is gone. This isn't going to happen. And not to make it all doom and gloom, but that is the truth of the way things are. How many of us are aging? How many of us have recently been afflicted by illness of any kind? I can't call cancer illness because it isn't, but the flu and the cold and the bronchitis I had following the last time I taught here a couple of weeks ago, you know, sickness, the Buddha talks about, you know, sickness, old age, death, birth. But this is what we have to look forward to. And I don't mean that in a really pessimistic way, but it's the deepest truth. Maybe not to look forward to, but the inevitable. It's the inevitable. So how can we be with this moment in the middle of this sickness? So somebody willing to talk about this last illness that and how you experienced it.
Julia. Well, I don't have one illness. I'm, as it says on my CD, I'm celebrating my 90th birthday. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of aging, and it just seems like everything's falling apart. And I feel very impeded by the fact that I'm limited and walking, and I'm feeling that more and more. Well, I'm lucky I can walk with this, but I mean, there are a lot of things that I can't do. Mm-hmm. And so I just feel lucky about a lot of things too, that I can still hear, I can still see. Can get around. I mean, I could sit at home, but I refuse to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where I am. Mm-hmm. Where do I go from here? Mm-hmm. What's ahead? Mm-hmm.
And what's your experience, if you remember, to be here with whatever's going on? What's that? How do you experience being present with what's going on?
Well, I get scared sometimes. And my doctor thinks I'm depressed. She gave me a little test to see if I was depressed. I said, well, I sleep well, and I'm always hungry. I don't think I'm depressed. And I think she thinks I'm a hypochondriac. I really do. I mean, it's hard to find a doctor that will look at you as an older person and what's happening. Mm-hmm. At least I found that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. We can be seen as our, put in the X. We can see ourselves as the X. I could see myself as having cancer. You could look at me and only see me as having cancer at this point. Sometimes it changes people's perspective drastically if you find out that someone has cancer. I mean, it's been my experience in the past that that's been the truth. People all of a sudden, it's like, I'm just a little bit different. Or you're not seen as a person. You're seen as an old person, a person with. And we identify ourselves with whatever the X is so often. In the beginning of this cancer diagnosis, kiddingly, and in a way to get closer and not deny it, because when you get diagnosed with breast cancer, I can tell you, you don't feel any different because there's nothing different in you, especially when you don't feel anything from the beginning. You know, a mammogram tells you there's something wrong. You go and have surgery, you don't feel great after surgery, but there's nothing different with you. You're not sick in any way. So in order to kind of like make it real, and just to be funny, to lighten the whole thing, because it can get kind of heavy with friends and family. And before I say this, I just want you to know my husband's a great guy. He's a great guy. And we kiddingly started calling me Cancer Girl. Kiddingly, just kind of as a way to get kind of close to it and kiddingly. I have to tell you, sometimes you get a few perks from having cancer too. So it's like, oh, Cancer Girl's going to get to go do this. You know, it's just a little joke. So then we shortened it to CG. And last week, Eric said something, you know, well, what do you think about that CG or something? And I said, I don't like that anymore. I said, I don't want that anymore. I said, it's not funny anymore. And I said, I'm not trying to be nasty or anything, but nope, done with that. And it was a good transition, because I don't think of myself as Cancer Girl anymore. In the beginning, it was actually kind of helpful. It was kind of helpful to, like, okay, it's helpful, but not helpful. It didn't serve at all anymore. So what about the labels that you put on yourself that you've carried with you for a long time? You know, some of us since childhood that don't serve anymore. They just don't serve anymore. Any labels aren't who we are. That's what this new earth or finding life's purpose to me is what is being said. It's like getting away from the labels that we stick ourselves with in that, I like to say, mumbly pig way. And mumbly pig, for those of you, I guess, who didn't grow up in the East Coast, is a game you play as a kid with knives. Anybody played mumbly pig? Okay, yes, all right. So mumbly pig, you're always putting a knife on a sharp place, you know, wherever it is, and you're flipping it and sticking it into the ground. So the knife sticks. If it sticks, you win. You get the point. But if the label sticks in our lives, in our heads, we don't get the freedom, the place of awakening to our life's purpose, which is to be free. It's to be free. It's to see clearly, which is where our practice leads. What mindfulness is all about is clear seeing into the truth of the way things are. And the way things are is last summer, Richard announced the birth of his son, his baby son, little baby. And I know, I wasn't here, but I know he talked about looking at him lovingly, recognizing this baby too, will grow old, will get sick, and will die. The deepest truth, everything's impermanent. Everything. Gut bodhicitta, you know, we all do. And part of the reason I am actually liking this dialogue with Eckhart Tolle is that he's taking away a lot of labels and understandings that people have locked themselves into regarding Christianity, regarding dogma, regarding beliefs, regarding Jesus, talking about Buddhist practice, Muslim, and debunking, you know, taking away all the misunderstandings from a clear perspective, from someone who says basically that the lions roar. The lion's roar that the Buddha said, I am awake. He talks about I am awake, not Eckhart Tolle as being awake, because anytime we even cling to the label of our names, of I am awake, we're not. It's too small. It's too small, it's too ego-laden, it's too selfing. But the I am of being and presence of wakefulness, which is the unconditioned truth of this moment and every moment, is just the flip side of the coin of this form of this body that's sitting here. It's just the flip side. It's nothing special. And it's so special. It's nothing special, and it's so special. Because it's here right now, we can't see. You talk about the moments of freedom that you can hear, you can see, you can use that to get around so that you aren't housebound. We forget those little moments. Those moments sometimes of walking in the park where you see the big picture, me sitting in a hot tub seeing the big picture, that you forget the little picture of suffering, the little picture of birthing of those little tiny buds, so sweet. Right now it's very sweet, seeing those little buds. So how do we live with the truth? How do we live with the truth of this ever-changing, impermanent world, this watercolor, this changing, shifting sand, where we want to find ground, our seat, take your seat, take your seat. We're told, we tell ourselves, take your seat and sit with what is. What if it's shifting? How do you take your seat in that? How do you take your seat in the middle of it all? Just stop for a minute and breathe. Just breathe. Now, let's just breathe. The breath isn't anything special either. It's so basic. It's so basic, and unless you have a cold and you're coughing with many of those breaths, or you're trying to sleep at night and you have a cold and your mouth's open. You wake up in the morning and your throat hurts. You know that one? Does everyone know that, or is that just me? Yeah. Okay. Everyone has those nose things closing up sometimes. And you just feel miserable, and it's really hard to be present. The hardest time for me in this cancer, since this cancer diagnosis, other than the two times of waiting for a pathology report, basically, was when I came back from this wonderful trip to Mexico and got sick and got one of those flu colds and went on antibiotics. Because this body's tendency is to create bacteria from a virus. So it hits my chest, and that's the way it is. And why that was so hard for me was because antibiotics and me don't mesh very well. This body reacts by feeling isolated and closed off, feeling separate, and disconnected. So a week of that is very hard. A lifetime of that is really hard. A lifetime of that is really hard. And that's what we come to practice for, I think, to take off the cataracts. Take off the cataracts, declutter the heart mind, just to declutter. Gut bodhicitta? Absolutely. Absolutely. The relative, the absolute, these terms are thought to be opposites. They aren't. It's all here right now. This form of the relative world, where we relate to each other, where antibiotics keep this mind-body from feeling related to other people, to what's going on in the world. It's like, ooh, the world's passing by, and I'm not part of it. You ever feel that way? That's painful. It's a really painful place. What do we do about it? How do we relate to it when we're not relating? Truly, that is a big question, and I think what practice is about is coming to see clearly that we're not unique. We're not unique. I know this woman. We're not separate. We're not special. We're very special because we're human beings and we have what's called the precious... We have this precious human birth with the potential to awaken to our life's purpose, which is to awaken. It's to awaken, to take the cataracts, just to see through those cataracts that keep the heart closed. Bodhicitta, Buddha heart. Buddha, awakened heart, mind. That's what bodhicitta is. The expression of bodhicitta, of the ultimate truth, of the ultimate truth, of the awakened, empty, awakened heart, mind, is lived in this relational world, the world of relativity, as compassion. It's its action in the world. Thich Nhat Hanh calls compassion a verb. Compassion is a verb. It's an action. So can we, in the midst of the hardest places, not feel sorry for ourselves, not feel sorry for other people, because that sets up a dual relationship. I feel sorry for me. I feel sorry for you. That's not what compassion is. Compassion is the open heart that is unafraid of looking at suffering. Sometimes it's this mind-body. Sometimes it's our own suffering. Oftentimes when we live out our lives through the conditioning of the past, through the conditioning of our childhood, that helped us so survive those families we grew up in, however we learned to relate to the families, however we learned was skillful. However we learned was skillful because it helped us to survive. Whatever we did to survive in some of our families that weren't so easy, it was skillful. If those ways of being in the world, of hiding, of not being present, of joking, of not seeing, of pushing away, of laughing, whatever the way is, if that way of conditioning is still here, which in many of us is hello, 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 it's there. There's no need to be mean. There's just no need to be mean to ourselves because the conditioning is still here. The only wise thing, when we really see the truth of the way things are, the only wise response is the heart that opens in compassion.
I think about this a lot. On the one hand, awakening is totally accessible. It happens right this moment. On the other hand, you can't make it happen. And that's what the practice is about. Mm-hmm. So I know that the goal is to awaken, to be compassionate. I mean, that's what I'm doing. But I can't make it happen any faster.
Mm-hmm. Nope. But you can have glimpses, and you can start to recognize those glimpses. Those glimpses of stillness, those glimpses of peace. And every time you recognize, instead of just going back to the pain, is a moment of freedom. It's a conditioning for the next moment. It's karma building. It's merit building. It's opening more ease. Every step on the path of this practice, which I think is such a gift. I mean, it's an incredible gift because the Buddha could have just hung out. And instead he chose to give this gift, which is such a gift. And it's a pointer. It's the path is a pointer to freedom. It's a pointer to freedom. So every step on the path, the Eightfold Path of wisdom, of clear seeing, of sila, which is morality. Now, no shoulds. No shoulds. But practice. No shoulds. No good, no bad. No shoulds. A practice of wisdom, of sila, or morality, and of concentration. They're pointers. They point us to. To me, it's kind of like, you know, you get this pointer of mindfulness of the mumbly pig. It's another way of looking at the mumbly pig. It's like you throw it up in the air and it points right to the truth. Mindfulness points right through to the truth. Does that make sense? The path is a pointer.
Well, I don't doubt what you're saying. I mean, that would...
Go ahead. Doubt's okay.
I do not doubt what you're saying. I believe this path, but do I know it? In split seconds.
Then...
Enough to stay with it. I know it enough to stay with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And split seconds is all we have. Split seconds is all we have, truly. That's even an idea, a split second. I remember someone on retreat, and I've said this before here on a metta retreat, someone said, you know, I could we did some practice within the forgiveness within the Metta retreat, and someone said, "This I just can't forgive this person. It was just unforgivable what that person did." And she said, and in this meditation, there was a nanosecond where I thought, "Well, maybe," and nanoseconds, no, split seconds, are worth paying attention to. So how do you treat yourself compassionately when you're having a hard time? Or do you? Or do you beat yourself up because, oh, I've been on this path for this many years and I know better. I should be doing better. I should be whatever. This person's been doing this for a long time and so have I. Look where this person is. It's painful. Isn't that painful? Isn't it? I think it's painful. It's really painful. It's really painful.
Well, I had an experience recently that I was very moved. I have read a book about Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. And I was very moved by his little couple of pages on appreciation. And I realized that I didn't appreciate other people enough or what was going on around me. Now, what happened was that I'm activities director where I live. And I had invited Chris Worthington, maybe some of you know Chris Worthington, to come and talk to us about the election that was coming up. He usually comes and talks about, lets us know both sides and helps us to make a decision or recommend stuff. And there was one person who couldn't come to the meeting. And she called me later, and so I just read his recommendations to her over the phone. And I don't know, I felt so good about it. I don't know, I just thought, well, and that feeling stayed with me for a long time. But it was just such a small thing to think that I could do that to help her out. And so, anyway, as I said, I've been very moved by that. By that, just those two little pages on
appreciation. Gratitude, appreciation. Gratitude is a huge practice. It's a huge practice. Anyone practice gratitude? How do you practice it? How do you practice it?
Well, I didn't know what you meant by practice, but for me, I always, well, sort of like prayer. Like, I think about all the things that are really, I appreciate, that are really special. And sometimes they're really big, like all the people I love most in my family. And sometimes they're very small, like, you know, noticing flower buds or, like, you know, where the air feels or something. But I do it every day, and usually a few times a day. I do it more when I'm just stressed and upset because I know that it helps, and then when everything's cool, I forget to be grateful. So
that's a very wise practice because oftentimes when we are feeling great, we put practice down, you know. That's wonderful. Yeah.
I had a practice I used for a while that I really got a lot out of, and that was a gratitude list I'd send to a group of people. And the only people that sent them back were so surprising to me. They ended up being people that because I don't email that much, so I just did an email to all of these different cousins, and you know, just to see what would come back. And I ended up having a gratitude list exchange with my niece, with my cousin in Canada, with all these people that I would never even think of picking the phone up to, and yet the people that I talked to regularly. So, and what it did did was I just would write the things that were really important to me, like this practice, like that, like this friend, or like certain things, and they would get to know my heart better, real deep stuff, instead of just, you know, loose stuff, or what I did, a little letter or something. It would be just a little list, like 10 things, what I'm grateful for, and then I'd hear what they were grateful for, and it really was kind of interesting.
What's your practice?
Gratitude is a verb too. Like this has been said, you know, it's, it was probably easier in some ways. When I found myself on my belly in my vomit, crying out to God, I had no relationship to after I'd been drinking myself to death for 35 years. please God help me, I can't do this alone. It was not that difficult to start being grateful for the fact that after all those years of trying and trying and trying to stop drinking, which unless you're an alcoholic, you do not understand how that is, that one drink can just take you to the end every time, and you don't understand, you know, the extraordinary demoralization that occurs when you cannot stop, think it stopped when I cried out for this help, whatever it was, whatever it was. And I got at that moment in my vomit lying on the face of it. I was lower than a worm, and I got this voice that, you know, a worm has a purpose. Mm-hmm. It actually aerates the earth and allows oxygen to breathe. And it was the beginning of my transformation, of course. This primary purpose is very, very dear to my heart, because within a month of getting sober, I had a revelation that all I had to do, if I never had another job, I stayed sober and helped other alcoholics achieve sobriety, I maintained my spiritual condition, and I became a custodian of this body that I hated and that I was trying to kill. Mm-hmm. And that this body is my temple, and that through it I would find its primary purpose, if I just kept things, you know, doing that. And if I had no other job, that would be fine for the rest of my life. You know, I didn't have to get paid for it. then I got a message to look up the word compassion, and the evenings, and look in the Bible. And in the Bible, I literally did this, and I opened it to the parables, and it said, honor thy father that begat thee, and hate not thy mother in her old age. And I cried for days. And, it's more than belief. Belief is not it, it's faith. Deepening that faith, as somebody said the other day, how do I feel this hope in myself? And I said, the only way is through faith. There's nothing out there, there's no thing, no person, you know, no religious belief that can fill that hope. It's faith. And faith comes from the mistakes and, you know, finding my feet again. You know, it's the spiritual warrior. You know, once we actually commit to this path that we are all talking about, whatever it looks like, you know, and as you so beautifully said, I have to constantly surrender what it looks like. Mm. Because if I attach to what it's supposed to look like, I will take, you know, the ego will take me back every time. So it's surrender. And gratitude helps me to surrender. I actually had to learn to say please for all the things I wasn't grateful for. I mean, thank you for all the things I wasn't grateful for. Really, literally, all the things I thought that were a bummer and a bitch and horrible. I practice saying thank you, God. Thank you, God. And I don't believe in God. I mean, it's not, it doesn't matter. It's a word that was easy for me. I embraced Vajrayana, Buddhism was my teacher, and which is wild. It's not, you know, I love this practice that we all do, but it's wild, you know. And it's taught me not to have shame and guilt, and to embrace whatever wonderful lives, you know, through that gratitude. And Qigong helped me a lot with that. I think I shared in this room that I spent 2 days after 9/11, and I joined 400 people in Berkeley. And we spent 3 hours with him talking about our anger.
Mm-hmm.
Not them, our anger.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really transformational.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a forever topic. And, you know, there's that wonderful thing where the masters will say, but you will be enlightened in this lifetime. You are enlightened. You are Buddha already. And then they talk about all these other these lifetimes, you know. And you go, ah!
Oh.
Yeah. You don't know what it looks like.
Always have this inability to see my lot. Thank you. Listening to each other, listening to people, to what's needed, to our own hearts, is the beginning of compassion. Really listening to what's needed. So I think I'd like to spend a couple of minutes in silence and go into your own heart, this own heart, this heart, and look at what's being asked. So just let the breath be easy. What's being asked for kindness, compassion in your life? Just breathe with it. If this was a baby, kitten, puppy, and needed help, you wouldn't turn your back. May we live our lives in truth, with honesty in the moment, not denying or pretending that things are okay when they're not, in this relative world we live in. Allowing the action of compassion to help us to sit with the hard times. May we go our separate ways, remembering to touch our own hearts. May we find peace, awakeness, and may the world remember peace. May the merit of our practice together be of benefit to all beings everywhere without exception. May the heart open as wide as the world and beyond.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.